there were some new
questions. This is the House Labor Committee meeting in hearing room A of the State Capitol. It's Wednesday, April 13, 8 a.m.
Morning, the House Labor Committee will come to order, please. Before we get down to our agenda, we want this to be a full one, and I want to move as quickly on it as we can. We do have a floor session at 10:45. Members have had distributed to their offices a request for a approval of drafting an introduction of a bill. I'm going to read that again in case members haven't had a chance to review it. We did send it out yesterday. Basically, the request comes from the Vocational Rehabilitation Division, and they've requested our approval for drafting an introduction of a bill to correct a situation which apparently has arisen over within their administration. Current law at ORS 655.605-615 provides workers' comp coverage through SAFE for individuals enrolled in the VRD's work programs. However, the law requires as a precondition for coverage that VRD affirmatively furnish SAFE with each of the names of the participants to be covered. Apparently, recently, a name was inadvertently omitted from the list, and the individual's later injuries were not covered by SAFE. Obviously not through that individual's fault. The proposed amendment would delete the requirement that VRD deliver a list to SAFE and provides instead that the names must be available to SAFE on request. And the Department of Justice, which has in part brought this situation to our attention, has provided the necessary language. And unless there are any questions or comments, I'd like to go ahead and make a motion that the committee go ahead and request that it be drafted and introduced. Representative Johnson makes that motion. Is there any further discussion? Is there any objection? It shall be so drafted and introduced with the concurrence of the Speaker's office. Okay, first up, we've got 2427 relating to between-term unemployment insurance benefits for school employees. And after our hearing on Monday, I think we reached the consensus that we're going to split the issues raised in 2220, that 2427 was going to become the vehicle for the issue concerning reasonable assurance or written notification to classified employees of between term or following term employment. I'm advised that the Employment Division, at our request, has worked up an amendment, and it's being distributed to members, and I'd ask Mr. Nairn and Ms. Hunter if they'd like to come forward and explain that amendment to us.
Mr. Chairman, we're on there in Employment Division. You probably have two documents. One is LC draft HB 2427-1, and the other is Employment Division draft dated April 13th, 1983, on proposed amendment to House Bill 2427. We saw the LC draft late yesterday afternoon, and so we saw some things that we were quite on target with what the committee had asked for, so we took the liberty of trying to fix it quickly because we weren't sure the legislative council could do it that quickly. So it's not been run by LC at all, our draft. The major differences is on the lead-in on line 3 of the LC draft, page 1, we added amending and then after 221 insert and declaring an emergency because the LC draft did not, and the instruction of the committee was to have a emergency clause.
That's correct.
In the substantive matter, which appears on page 2 of the LC draft, line 27, our draft would insert between the word subsequent and year the word academic. We need that to be in tune with the federal language. On page 3 of the LC draft, what is Now, Section 2 in the LC draft really referred to the section when we were considering 2220. It does not really apply to this when it's pulled out in this piece of it. So that was deleted. So then what shows up on the LC draft, Section 3, would become Section 2 in our draft. And then our Section 3 adds the emergency clause.
Okay, I think that's pretty straightforward. You have, I think I'd ask members to work off the proposed amendment prepared by the Employment Division. And again, that has the differences that Mr. Nairn has explained focus in three areas. First of all, it has the emergency clause. So we're speaking about this current summer interval or summer break would be included within the scope of the bill. And also the clarification as to academic year, so there's no confusion in the subparagraph 6. And then just the deletion of the Section 2 in the LC draft, which Mr. Nairn has advised is not going to be necessary because since we're dealing with a separate bill, we're not concerned about splitting the or effective dates. And we do have in Section 2, at your request, the kind of fail-safe language in case there's some reason that the U.S. Department of Labor and its grace find some problem that we're off the hook.
That's correct. Just as a final comment there, there's no fiscal impact now with this, with what we have in the bill. It's my end, would be my end, feeling. Is, would you confirm that?
If there is one, it would be one that we would be unable to determine simply because we cannot predict precisely how the educational institutions will react to the May 30th filing date, and we're assuming that they would give notice, and so if that does happen, then there would not be an impact.
Yeah, I know the reason I wanted that on the record because we've got a one with $20 million impact. I just want to be sure we...
That's for the old bill. Yeah, I appreciate that clarification. Let me, do you have folks have any comments or are there any questions from members of the committee for the representatives of the Employment Division? Hey, if not, let me ask any individuals in the audience who have participated or want to make a comment, yay or nay, at this time. Mr. Auerbach?
Thank you, Representative Springer. Members of the committee, we had Roger Auerbach, Oregon Federation of Teachers. We had an opportunity to talk with both Ms. Hunter and Mr. Nairn before the hearing and have looked over their proposed amendments that you have in front of you labeled Employment Division, and we have no problem with it as it's drafted.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Auerbach? Okay, if not, Mr. Donnelly.
Jerry Donnelly from the Oregon School Employees Association. As Mr. Auerbach just indicated, we've also had an opportunity to look over this as it's been amended by the Employment Division this morning, and we're also in support of the bill as amended.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Anyone else? Okay, if not, is there a motion on the amendments? Representative Johnson moves the adoption of the amendments proposed to House Bill 2427. These are the amendments prepared by the Employment Division. Is there any further discussion? Is there any objection to the amendments? If not, they're adopted. Is there a motion on the bill?
Mm-hmm.
Representative Gold moves House Bill 2427 as amended to the floor with a two-pass recommendation. Any comment? Discussion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Brigiotti?
Aye.
DeVore?
Aye.
Gold?
Aye.
Hanlon?
Aye.
Johnson?
Aye.
Leek?
Aye.
Shipwreck?
Aye.
Springer?
Aye. Vote adopted. 2427 is reported to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. Record should show that Representative Ford is excused. Are there any volunteers?
Here.
Gee, that was quick. Representative Gold, I should have known. I should have known. I apologize for not anticipating that soon. Thank you.
I really do. Apparently, one
you can have the rest of them.
No.
There'll be a few others.
There's some that I won't tell.
Once we screen them, there.
Okay, the next bill up is 2595. Modifies what is suitable work for unemployment compensation eligibility. This was carried over from Monday at the request of Mr. Frederick and I think some other members of the committee who, and also in order to permit legislative counsel to review the amendment that had been proposed by Representative Hanlon bearing the date April 1st, 1983 and further amended in committee. Based upon, I understand, conversations between Representative Hanlon, counsel, and others who had expressed a concern. We do have the revised amendments before us in the LC draft, which council is distributing at this time. As soon as they're distributed, I'd go ahead and ask Representative Hanlon or council or whoever wishes to sort of lead us through these amendments. Representative Hanlon, do you wish to?
Mr. Chairman, I think I would ask that the Employment Division come up because we were in conference concerning this, and I think what's been done can be readily explained.
Great, I think that'd be appropriate too. Mr. Nairn and Ms. Hunter, your assistance, please. Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, Ron Nairn, Employment Division. We got a copy of LC draft 2595-1 is 4/12/83 late yesterday. We then rather carefully proofed it against the language that appeared on starting on the bottom of page 2 of Representative Hanlon's proposed amendment dated April 1, 1983 to see if there was anything, any difference other than form and style. And we believe at this time that the form and style written by legislative counsel does accurately reflect the language that Representative Hanlon proposed as amended. In, there were a couple of changes in that document of April 1st, 1983. So we believe it is an accurate representation of that.
Okay, the LC draft, as you reviewed it, presents no problems to your interpretation or administration.
Yes, our interpretation would still be that it would apply to if one offers a work, that it would still apply to the laid-off workers because it does refer to the individual's employer, and that would be the only place that we can see where there would be an employer-employee relationship, which is what we testified to earlier. And we believe that this language still contains that same interpretation.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Hanlon.
Ron, this LC draft also includes an amendment of 657-200 on page 3. In my discussion with your office, we discussed the necessity and non-necessity of amending 200. Could you speak to that?
Representative Hanlon, yes, as we discussed earlier, we cannot conceive a situation where we would reach 200 in a factual situation. Not necessarily to say that there couldn't be one, but all of us have thought about every conceivable situation where we could get there with this set of facts, with any set of facts. And we believe that every set of facts we can think of would be covered by subsection 5 of 176. And there
so the only relevant amendments from the LC draft would be pages 1 and page 2, not page 3.
That's my opinion, yes.
And that's my understanding too.
Hey, let me, Representative Hanlon, let me ask, has Mr. Frederick had an opportunity to review or consider the amendment, and do you feel comfortable in representing whether or not he has any objections at this point?
Yes, he has reviewed, and yes, I feel comfortable. I think he is comfortable with this as amended, and I don't see him in the audience.
Kirk over there.
Okay, Mr. Berger, can you give a yay or nay to?
I couldn't hear you.
Why don't you come forward and place your comments and name on the record, Mr. Berger.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Kirk Berger, representing the Association of Oregon Counties and League of Oregon Cities. And I just went down the hall where Carl was in Senate Labor and showed him the amendments. He didn't get a chance to...
Let me interrupt you, Mr. Okay. Berger. We just indicated that page 3 would not be a part of the amendments on the LC draft. And I know that you left this meeting early yesterday. Anyway, 200 is not to be amended.
Okay, great.
So do you want to put some comments on the record?
Then we are comfortable with what is being done. Sorry for the confusion.
I heard you say it, and I don't know if I believe it or not. Do you just do that? Did I see an amendment? So we're going to deal with page 1 and 2 and insert that in the bill 2595. And that's all. Page 3 is not going to be used.
That's correct.
Okay. I
appreciate that.
I suddenly got my color back.
Appreciate the clarification.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, too, Mr. Frederick did say in my presence that he had no problem with it when we were with Mr. Representative Hanlon. But with just pages 1 and 2, he had no problem with it.
Okay. So in the interest of agreement, compromise, reconciliation, as Representative Johnson has so aptly demonstrated, forget page 3.
Mr. Chairman, is that all section 2 then is not included?
Now just page 1 and 2 would be all you'd have.
Line 27.
Well, but section 2 starts on line 27.
I believe you want to throw away section 2, Mr. Chair, and not page 3, which
yeah,
has the emergency
correct.
Clause on
we'll
it.
Keep the E clause,
yeah.
Emergency okay. clause. That'll
at
be the new section
2.
Is everybody...
all of
section
2
is
right?
That's
okay.
correct.
All right.
Okay. Okay, are we all clear now just what Representative Hanlon's amendment is at this point?
Mr. Chairman. Just a clarification of the auto clarification of the need for the emergency clause, whether there are situations such as this in process right now where we might need the emergency clause, we might not. We're prepared to rationalize it on the floor.
That thought crossed my mind, and I felt confident that the carrier of the bill, if the committee asks successfully on it, passes successfully, Representative Hanlon will be able to respond to that question when it's raised.
Do you want to send?
I will.
Okay.
You think you can? I mean,
I think I can.
Okay. Any further question about the amendments?
Mr. Chairman, just a clarification. Talked about page 3 and. Section, what appears now as Section 3 is emergency clause, which would become Section 2 if it's there. And I guess just a matter of clarification for our information, does Section 3 become Section 2 so there is an emergency clause, or does it not?
That's the intent.
That would be the intent, yes. And when the amendments are printed, council will so instruct the Legislative Council's office.
Thank you.
If, I assume that's the will of the committee. Anyone else in the audience want to comment? One way or the other. Okay. If not, Representative Hanlon moves the proposed amendments to House Bill 2595, bearing the date, that's Legislative Council Draft Number 1, bearing the date April 12, 1983.
Mr. Chairman, I have a comment before
yes.
The adoption of the amendment. I just would like to say for the record that my amendments of April 1, 1983, which included the words hours and conditions, which are not in the present amendment, should not be taken as any kind of legislative history either one way or the other in the adoption of the present wording.
Okay. I mean, I'm not sure I understand exactly what that means, but that's your statement as to intent. You're certainly welcome to it.
We may have to argue in court somewhere.
Any further question or comment? Is there any objection to the amendment proposed by Representative Hanlon? Not, it's adopted. Okay, Representative Hanlon moves House Bill 2595 as amended to the floor with a two-pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
McGoer?
Aye.
Gold?
Aye.
Hanlon?
Aye.
Johnson?
Aye.
Lee?
Aye.
Shiprack?
Aye.
Buzzati?
Aye.
Stringer?
Aye.
Motion's adopted. 2595 to the floor. Do pass as amended. And the record will note that Representative Ford is excused. House Bill 2883.
Moving right along.
Excuse me. Representative Hanlon will carry 2595. 2883. This has been the council. Maybe you can refresh my memory. I wasn't present on the day when this was originally heard, but can you give us a little background information?
Have you ever had a hearing?
It's my understanding it was heard 2.5 weeks ago.
The bill was first heard at a time when a portion of the committee was absent on a delegation to Olympia, Washington, and I believe that Representative Johnson chaired the meeting that day. House Bill 2883 seeks an exemption from workers' comp coverage for a category of people which the bill calls foster grandparents and senior companions who are volunteers participating in the ACTION program. The ACTION program is, of course, a federal program funded by federal dollars. My understanding of the testimony at the previous hearing is that the individuals who participate in this federal program receive a stipend of $2 an hour, which is intended to cover their miscellaneous expenses of transportation, clothing, et cetera, but they are not paid a formal wage. The federal law, in fact, dictates that the stipend which they receive is not to be construed as a wage and is not to be subject to employment taxes. However, the state law of Oregon, and I understand of other states, on workers' comp is worded in such a way that receipt of any money such as this could be construed as a wage, making those individuals workmen or workers subject to the workers' comp laws.
Let's ask, I understand, I spoke with Representative Reichen just before the hearing commenced. He's got an incredibly overloaded schedule this morning, or he would be here personally. It's my understanding that the individual who brought this concern to Representative Reichen is present and may respond to any questions. I'm not sure if there are any amendments proposed. It appears the language in the bill is pretty straightforward, but I'd like to ask perhaps Mr. Young from the Workers' Comp Department to come forward. I'm not sure if he's necessarily prepared to testify, but I guess it would be helpful to me to know how these folks, how it is they may or may not be caught up in the net of the employee status or a subject worker.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, I'm Larry Young, Administrator of the Compliance Division of the Workers' Compensation Department. Basically, this exemption under the Workers' Compensation Act really addresses a specific group of a specific organization, federal organization, and exempts them exclusively and does not add any other type of volunteer personnel into the exemption. The only thing, as always, with the exemption or making non-subject workers is it does place the employer of a non-subject worker under the common law liability, and they're subject to the torts in that area. But it's a federal agency. I'm sure they have sufficient liability insurance. The department certainly has no position on this bill as far as opposing or...
Mr. Young, apparently the reason folks are here is because there's been an there may have been an interpretation. I don't know if they've contacted you earlier and asked to... it may be that Safe Corporation had not put the heat on him, but at least talked to him and expressed the opinion that they would could very well be within the definition of subject employee. Have they asked you for an interpretation, or has your division taken a position as to whether or not, if the question were presented to you, if you had one of their people who was hurt and they filed a claim, can you give us any guidance along those lines?
Mr. Chairman, after the testimony during the last hearing on this, our counsel came up with a correspondence they had with Mr. Stivers in October 11th, 1976, in which the question was posed to the board of what the whether coverage would be required. And at that time, it was of the opinion and not necessarily a decision, but if there was an incident involved, they would result in being considered subject workers. And I believe that correspondence has eventually led to this.
Okay, are there any further questions for Mr. Young? If not, thank you for your comments. Do we have Mr. Stivers here?
Mr. Chairman, to the committee members, my name is Steve Stivers. I'm the state program director for the Federal Agency Action, which has these two programs under question under its aegis.
Okay, I know that you've had a chance to present some earlier testimony and comments, and I apologize for not being here, and I particularly if I'm going to ask questions that have already been asked, but I just for my own clarification, apparently in 76 you asked for an interpretation, you were advised it'd be a good idea to get coverage, we think your people are subject employees. Have you had coverage since 1976?
We've had coverage. The foster grandparent program is a program which started in 1967 and has been under these provisions of the Safe Corporation since that time. The senior companion program, the other program in question, came into being in 1975 and was immediately placed under the provisions of Safe for the same reasons that foster grandparent. In those years, I've been the program director since 1971, and through those years, we've had a number of conversations, et cetera, related to the problems between the federal legislative intent to create a programs which enable people to volunteer, and the state interpretation, which says that anybody who receives a direction or remuneration for any services rendered will be considered wages. We have no quarrel at all with SAFE. I think it's been a very fine relationship, and that meeting in 76 was a very pleasant meeting. This isn't a confrontation between the two agencies. At that time, I had asked SAFE to make their interpretation that they would not consider the stipends as wages. However, they're very correct in their interpretation of the state. We have no argument with that at all, as the state now portrays it, that under the state provision, it would be considered wages. So it comes down, then, what we need is the federal purpose for the programs are enabling the funds, the stipends are to enable people to volunteer, and in no way is to be construed to be adjuncts to their income or to do that type of thing. All it is to enable an indigent person over 60 years old to participate in those two volunteer programs. We have many other volunteer programs in which some volunteers do exactly the same things as the senior companions or foster grandparents, but do not have are not covered by SAFE. I would also like to add that we do have an insurance, as Mr. Young pointed out, which covers that. Of course, it's not to the depth that SAFE is. But again, the federal government does not consider the stipends to be wages. There isn't any intention to continue stipends on. There is personal liability insurance. There is accident insurance. And there is excess auto provided. And this is provided by the programs for the people. So there is a coverage, but it isn't in the depth. For example, as SAFE points out, a volunteer who would be injured under SAFE would consider to receive...
Any further questions for Mr. Dearborn?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Hamlin.
Mr. Dearborn, do I understand the present law being there already is a firefighter's presumption in law?
That's correct.
So this body has already made a policy decision that that particular class will have a presumption in lieu of medical evidence. Wouldn't you say that's a fair statement?
Yes.
Are you aware of the bursting bubble theory?
No.
Maybe I ought to ask your counsel when we get to her.
Yes, we'll have a little review of evidence from Ms. Launder. Any further questions from Mr. Dearborn? If not, thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Who's next?
I will attempt to not restate a number of items that Mr. Dearborn has already stated, and therefore my written testimony will not precisely follow what I am about to state orally. It's my understanding that this committee has already heard testimony on the effect of this change on the economics of local government, and it is my purpose to emphasize the impact of the change on the present unique status of firefighters within the workers' compensation system. At the present time, as Representative Hamlin has stated, the firefighters enjoy a presumption of compensability, which, however, can be challenged by competent medical evidence on the part of the employer showing that the disease involved in, or excuse me, the condition involved, in fact, is not a result of working conditions. The proposed amendment to ORS 656-802 would make that presumption conclusive. What this means is that no evidence could be presented by the employer to challenge the compensability of a claim. This is a unique position in the workers' compensation system. The general rule is that the system provides for an adversarial determination of the compensability of claims. All parties have an interest in the claim, who have an interest in the claim, have the opportunity to request a hearing and to present evidence in protection of their interest. The change proposed by House Bill 2700 is an aberration of that system. The conclusive presumption that is established denies the employer any opportunity to protect its interest, that interest being making payments to only those workers who in fact have suffered as a result of their employment. This interest in a fair assessment of the facts of each claim is also ultimately the interest of the taxpaying public. The proposed amendment to ORS 656-802 establishes a rule of law, not a factual presumption. The claimant need only show proof of specific disease and of firefighting employment in order to be eligible for compensation. The employer can submit no evidence of any other contributing factors to the firefighter's condition, such as heredity or a lifetime of heavy smoking, to support a denial of the claim. No other public employee group, no matter how hazardous its working conditions, enjoys such a privilege. The proposed change is simply inappropriate and unfair and establishes a rule of law which mitigates against a fair and just administrative system. The committee should also recognize that the adoption of House Bill 2700 may have significant negative impact on the working conditions of firefighters. As the committee may know, the City of Salem has recently adopted a civil service rule covering all firefighters who are hired after March 9, 1983, which requires that those employees agree to abstain from smoking cigarettes on or off the job. This rule was enacted as a move to reduce the legitimate risk of non-employment-related diseases being deemed compensable under the current rebuttable presumption. The city's rule has incited significant public response, the majority of that response being negative. The public apparently perceives this regulation of the private habits of employees as an unsubstantiated and unreasonable invasion of the firefighters' right to privacy. Yet, the harsh rule of House Bill 2700 will justifiably lead more employers to promulgate such work rules for their firefighters in order to protect the public employer's economic interests. The committee may in fact be doing a disservice to firefighters by recommending passage of House Bill 2700. Under the present law, these firefighters who have legitimately compensable conditions already have no burden to prove an employment-related cause of that condition. Already, they have a benefit not enjoyed by any other public employees. The expansion of this special benefit into a rule of law is not in the best interest of either the employer or the employee. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to recognize Representative Hamlin so he can raise his question about the Thayer versus Morgan position as to the value or effect of a presumption.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to get back to my bursting bubble. Are you aware of the cases involving the existing presumption and how the courts have treated them?
No.
Oh. Well, let me expound.
I have the feel you want to kind of respond to your own question.
The presumption that presently is in the law that favors the firefighters as a class says that these matters are presumed to have, if the disease is present, these matters are presumed to have arisen out of and in the course and scope of employment. The difficulty with the amendments, and there have been two different changes in wording, is that the courts in this state, and I'm talking about Wright versus Safe, apparently recognize the bursting bubble theory. And what that means is once employer produces any medical evidence, in this case, any doctor's opinion that you might request for an independent exam, the presumption disappears. And then employee is bound to produce as if the statute that is already enacted never existed. It is my understanding the purpose of the bill before us today is to deal with what the courts apparently haven't paid any attention to this body in dealing with by adapting the bursting bubble theory.
Can you call that the name of the bill, the bursting bubble
theory?
May I comment, Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I am The reason I said no in quite the abrupt manner that I did is that I do not practice in the workers' compensation area. As a general matter, the City of Salem is self-insured and retains outside counsel. However, I do practice in the civil courts, and as the committee may be aware, there is a new set of Oregon rules of evidence which govern civil matters, and the bursting bubble theory of presumptions to which you refer has been repudiated in those rules. So I guess my comment would be that as to future decisions under this kind of a, under the present law where the presumption is rebuttable, that rule of the bursting bubble may very well be changed. And in fact, it's my understanding that the way presumptions, rebuttable presumptions are to be treated is that the person against whom or the party against whom the presumption is asserted has the burden of proving the contrary. And so that would set up what is certainly in the assessment of most counsel, I guess, a more appropriate way to treat a presumption, to make it a true presumption.
The comment that I have is that you're talking about Section 17, Rule 308 of the Oregon Rules of Evidence, and this does apply to presumptions in civil proceedings in
That's
which the
correct.
Bursting bubble theory is thrown out the window. However, this workers' compensation system is a special animal that has its own interpretations of civil law, and a board that makes and referees that make substantive decisions on the application of rules of evidence. And in fact, there's specifically in the statute a thing that says it doesn't have to follow any other particular evidentiary rules. And therefore, I think the purpose of the statute before us is as it is. I'd certainly be interested in hearing any comments you have on how to this body can carry out its policy decision to favor firefighters on respiratory and heart disease. Even without a is there any other way to do it other than to enact a conclusive presumption is basically my question of you. And make sure that gets carried out, that policy decision gets carried out.
I guess I would defer to Mr. Dearborn as a comment.
Representative Hamlin, if I might offer a comment on right versus safe, which should be taken in light of the fact that I'm not an attorney. My understanding of that court case was that indeed it reinforced the presumption that was disregarded by the appeals court decision. And in fact, it held that the presumption had the weight of evidence, even in the face of contradictory medical evidence asserting that the injury was not caused by employment. And that in that case, because the presumption was in fact not successfully disputed in its entirety, having been given the weight of evidence resulted in the claim being held compensable. So I think that case seems to reinforce the employer's burden that not only does he have to present simply contradictory medical evidence, but that evidence has to overwhelmingly disprove the presumption that employment was the cause of the disease.
Well, I've got the decision right here, and I disagree with your analysis of it. And I also talked to the lawyer that represented the fireman. Knew him quite well. I don't think that is the interpretation put on it on right versus safe. And although I will admit that perhaps the Supreme Court decision was less than totally clear in instructing the lower courts, it appears it certainly did not repudiate the bursting bubble theory in any way.
Just to clarify the
there's been reference to the rule of evidence when you read what that now says. And this has been effective only for about just over a year's time. Under Oregon Rule of Evidence 308, presumptions in civil proceedings, in civil actions and proceedings, presumption poses on the party against whom it is directed the burden of proving that the non-existence of the presumed fact is more probable than its existence. That's a strengthening, if you will, or the value of presumption. I'm not sure how that's going to affect the court's interpretation, since Wright, there's only one way we're going to find out, and that's if a lawsuit goes up on that issue. I guess Representative Hanlon's point is, does this change in the evidence code in itself represent a strengthening of the presumption? How do we find, or is there any middle ground to the policy that he addresses? Or how... I guess I'll rely upon the representative of the firefighters to state their case, but I believe they felt that every time a claim is made, they face lengthy, expensive, costly litigation expenses to try to prevail on the claim, and that's part of the reason that they're here, and I guess they're finding a mechanism that will avoid that, if possible.
Which would be the...
And certainly a conclusive presumption is one way to avoid that. Representative Leake.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was wondering if you see any way that we might be able to reinforce this bubble without encasing it in concrete, which seems to be where we're going here. Is there some way that we, from what I'm hearing, the court situation has remained really murky. There's still a lot of argument can be made. Is there some place between the current law and this conclusive presumption that the city of Salem could be comfortable with and would deal as well, do you think, with the firefighters' concerns?
I wouldn't suggest you necessarily have an answer right now.
But I'm just asking
this a question in the air that I think we will be coming back to a subsequent work session, and if you feel that more time will allow you a more accurate response, feel free.
The only comment I would have is obviously not a detailed one. Our principal concern, as I said before, is that 2700 removes the presence of medical evidence. The legislature in the current law has asserted a policy judgment that presumption should exist for firefighters. It has not, by that policy, preempted the question of medical causality. It still allows that question to be determined by a consideration of medical evidence. Whatever amendment to the present law is judged necessary, I think, needs to reserve an appropriate place for the consideration of medical evidence. I don't believe that it's appropriate for the legislative body to presume that in all future cases, the specific medical circumstances of which cannot be known to it, employment and not a host of other risk factors, which in and of themselves are associated with a statistically high incidence of these diseases, cause the disease, and that there is no possibility to present medical evidence that argues to the contrary.
Well, I guess the problem goes to the fact that what's happening is indeed all these cases obviously are being argued on medical grounds, and it seems to me that what you're saying is that no, we can't change the current system because we need to continue to have these arguments, and what the firefighters are saying is these arguments are dragging out forever and they're not always appropriately made. So is your, but am I accurately getting your answer that no, you don't think that there's any middle ground? Is that what you're saying here?
I'm saying that if you don't believe that the adversary process is an appropriate way to introduce and weigh medical evidence, because the source of that medical evidence is questionable or whatever reason it may not be conclusively competent, then perhaps there is another way to obtain that same medical opinion and introduce it for consideration by the board or by the courts. It may be an independent board of medical examiners that's established for the purpose of reviewing this kind of thing. I don't know.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay. Again, I'm not sure we're going to find the answer in this hearing. Go ahead.
Thank you. Again, my name is Susie Wagner. I'm the risk manager for the city of Eugene. I apologize for not having written testimony. I will summarize my testimony and provide you with copies following today's hearing. The city of Eugene also opposes the passage of House Bill 2700. I won't restate the testimony, the substance of the testimony that's been presented already. I'll try and give you a different perspective on things from the city's point of view. To address the causality question, the medical causality question, again, there is a general consensus among the medical community that there are several risk factors, separately or in combination, that are predictors of the early onset of coronary heart disease, which is the most common form of cardiovascular disease. I emphasize the word early because every year about half of all Americans die of heart disease, regardless of occupation. I think an important thing to remember is that there has been that the link between firefighting and these risk factors is speculative at best, and certainly not conclusive. The policy that was set by the legislature regarding the presumption, to the best of my knowledge, was set in 1959. That's the best I could do in terms of finding out when the presumption law was established. There's been a lot of change in the medical community's attitude about the causality of heart disease between 1959 and today. I also wanted to go back and take a look at the city of Eugene Fire Department since about 1959 and compare the fire department then with the fire department today. So I went back to 1951 and looked at the statistics from the annual report. The point I'm trying to make is that this is an Oregon law covering Oregon firefighters, and that comparisons between Oregon firefighting companies and those in Los Angeles or Chicago or New York are not realistic. Let me give you some figures about the fire companies in 1951 at the city of Eugene. The department had 47 members. During 1951, those 47 fire department employees performed about 1,000 inspections for the purpose of fire prevention. They spent about 700 hours in training, and they fought 518 actual fires. I looked at the 1982 annual report and saw that the department had increased to 172 members, which is about a 260% increase over the 1951 staffing level. The number of inspections in 1982 was 7,183, which is an increase over the 1951 level of about 600%. Training hours in 1982 were 12,633, which is 18 times the number of hours spent on training in 1951. The number of actual fires in 1982 was 654, which is a 26% increase over the level in 1951. Assuming that 80% of the department employees are firefighters, the average firefighter in 1982 worked on 4 fires during the year. The average loss per fire in the city of Eugene was $4,000, to give you an idea of the severity. This information is given to you just to put the put in perspective the profession of firefighting in Oregon relative to profession of firefighting in other communities or states. The current law, as we see it, is fair and adequate, and we are not seeking its repeal. But we feel that I would agree that the current law places an undue burden on both the employer and the employee, and I would eagerly accept any alternative that would relieve the burden to both employers and employees. But at this point in time, opening up the law to make it a conclusive presumption would be an unfair burden to the taxpayers and to the Oregon workers' comp system.
Let me ask a couple questions. Does your fire department do rescue and ambulance work as well?
Yes.
Okay. When you do submit your written comments, could you include as well some documentation of what your claim experience has been?
We've had, I can give you some of that now, but I don't have all of the information with regards to appeals. I do know that we've had 14 files claimed over the last 12 years, and that those claims, all 14 of those claims were denied. Of those claims that were appealed, the denials were all upheld in appeal. I might also point out that some of the claims that were filed by firefighters who suffered from rheumatic fever, viral infection, or congenital heart diseases or defects, all of which would have been, the city would have had to assume as compensable had the house bill in question been in law at the time.
Are you folks self-insured?
Yes, we are.
And let me ask, it's a question I didn't raise with Salem, but it's another kind of overall policy issue. To what extent do you have disability insurance as part of your benefit package for a disability that may occur to one of your employees, firefighter or otherwise, non-job related situation?
The city of Eugene has about 1,000 employees, 174 of which are firefighters. We have 4 union groups and an exempt group. All employees, with the exception of firefighters, are covered by a long-term disability policy that provides 60% of the gross salary for an employee that's disabled. The firefighters have elected not to bargain for long-term disability coverage. So it's available to all employees except firefighters.
Okay. Representative Hamlin.
I have a comment, maybe anyone or all of the three of you might want to comment back, but I've heard other factors and unfair being put into the testimony, and I just want to make the record clear that the standard that the courts use, that the court and the board uses, depending on whether it's an occupational disease or an injury, is that the injury or disease must be either a major or a material contributing factor, not necessarily the sole cause of the disability produced, so that's in the record.
Any further questions? Representative Lee.
Mr. Chairman, did I get it right? The firefighters in the city of Eugene are batting 0 for 14 on their claims. Okay. That kind of indicates to me that unless all 14 claims were clearly unfounded, that there may be a problem that we need to address in this area.
And I want
that kind of raises the question that there's something that needs to be changed.
No, I don't. I don't because in reviewing the claims before coming down here, I did notice that there were claims filed by a person that had rheumatic fever, which is totally unrelated to firefighting, and heart disease, the natural progression following rheumatic fever. Viral heart infections induced a heart attack in another individual, and two of the other individuals had congenital heart diseases or defects. So
there's no firefighter who, as a result of his or her employment over the last 15, 20 years, has come down with any disability in the city?
In my opinion, that's correct. The city has granted heart claims for employees in other departments over the same period of time. So we don't make frivolous denials. We don't feel we make frivolous denials.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr.
Chairman. Representative
Hamlin. I think it's also fair to say, and I heard the comments earlier about a medical board, and I'm not particularly in favor of that, but I think it's also fair to say that the medical profession and the sub-opinion groups within the medical profession have been grappling for years in the area of causation, especially related to heart claims, and the state of the art of the opinions and the different schools involved within that profession of cardiology is such that I think we have to, in fairness to both sides on this issue, we have to do the best we can, and I believe the forum is within the legal mechanisms of the process and not in a separate medical board. This is something even though we've progressed since 1951, I'm not sure how far. Thank you.
Feel better? Sorry, I couldn't resist. Any other questions or comments from our witnesses? Thank you very much for your testimony. We look forward to your written remarks, Ms. Wagner. Mr. Whalen.
I'm glad you brought that up because I thought he was in pain.
Mr. Whalen.
I'm Tom Whalen, Oregon State Firefighters Council. As far as the evidentiary burden goes, I think that's been discussed. We've pushed that as far either away from the bursting bubble theory to the current state of a presumption in Oregon law. The problem is that we have is that there are still physicians out there that deny that the conditions that the firefighter operates under in the workplace do not contribute to heart disease. As Representative Hanlon indicated, there's a real divergence in thought on just what the causative factors are in heart disease. We can only extrapolate from the type of objective statistical evidence that we've been able to produce. And when you try to take that and narrow that down to one individual case and say, did firefighting cause that individual's disability, there's going to be a physician that can be had out there that will say no. It's almost an article of faith, it seems. I guess as much as the objective evidence that we have, it's the subjective feeling that we go through every time we're involved in an incident, every time we're involved in the stresses of a fire. You simply cannot voluntarily push your body to that extreme. And when you look at the fact that firefighters going in are a medically select group, and that the management has within their power to negotiate no smoking clauses in the contract, they have the authority, the right to give stress electrocardiograms upon hiring, to rule out any congenital defects or underlying ischemic heart disease. There's ways that they could encourage, and in fact in some cases have mandated, as in the city of Salem, ongoing physical fitness programs with aerobic conditioning. The